is the length, and 60 thousandths, 0.06 inches, is the width of the components. You can hold them with your fingers, and you can hold them down with a toothpick as you solder them into position. And if you've got a young set of eyes, you might not even need magnification. But the more modern surface mount, smaller components, without the right kind of equipment, are very difficult to work with. But QEX, as Eric is saying, has in almost every issue some very nice articles that are easy to reproduce. So hopefully Bob will get a chance to do that. I hope you're still hearing me, Bob. And Bob, as this project progresses, whether it be successful or unsuccessful, please come back and give us a progress report and let us know how it's going. KC2, Echo Mike Alpha, for any final. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Nothing other than thank you very much for all the ideas. I will let you know whenever I come back to New York, I'll try and let you all know. Thank you for your help, and hopefully we see something. Hope to see some of you on the air in the future as I address Fairfield, Connecticut. KC2EMA, mobile, back to next.
2KEY, got a further comment for...
Got a further comment. Go right ahead, Mel.
Something recently that I thought was very interesting, you know, being as apropos to what we were talking about, television and UHF, DHF band, was to build a simple, was on, in fact, I looked at it on, I saw it in QST originally, and it's on the ARRL website, is a simple spectrum analyzer that is made from tuners and parts from old VCRs or TV sets or cable boxes, over.
Yeah, not a bad suggestion. The tuner assembly of a modern-day television set has a voltage-controlled oscillator that has a very wide range to it. So that as a swept RF front end, and some of them even have a swept RF amplifier with tuner in front of that swept local oscillator. That becomes one of the most difficult parts of a spectrum analyzer. That combined with the right kind of a IF filter, IF amplifier, logarithmic detector, and then an oscilloscope for display can make a rather nice spectrum analyzer. A spectrum analyzer, until very, very recently, was the most often used piece of RF test equipment in a radio laboratory. The only thing that's now challenging that is a so-called network analyzer. A network analyzer is capable of measuring all of the scattering parameters, input impedance, output impedance, forward gain, and reverse gain, all four of those measurements in a vector manner. A network analyzer contains a signal generator and a very precise calibrated amplitude and phase receiver combined into one box. So you take any piece of RF electronics, I don't care if it's something as simple as a piece of cable or a connector, or as complicated as a whole IF strip, you can put that on your network analyzer, and it will give you a beautiful set of curves on that screen that will tell you the performance of your device on the test. And what I do every single day is that I'm using a network analyzer as a antenna laboratory. Between my desk and my conference table, which is 3 feet away, with a bunch of anechoic material scattered on the desks and on the floor, that is the 900 megacycle antenna range by which I construct antennas. The network analyzer is being used with two simultaneous displays. It's got a color display. I've got a yellow display for the standing wave ratio and a blue display for the gain. As far as the network analyzer is concerned, I call it standing wave ratio, but it's displaying what it calls S11. And I also care about gain, and it's displaying what it calls S21. And so these antennas are being developed in the real world with pieces of copper on insulating materials and feed lines fed to them and a sensing antenna 3 feet away. And as silly and as simplistic as that sounds, that test setup has resulted in a significant number of patent applications for new antennas for the 900 megacycle license-free band. Anybody have any further questions or comments on what has come so far? Give me your call letters at this time and name, K2RIW. I think the next person who signed in, let's see, was that possibly Steve, KC2MDP? Either him or somebody who said he's got a quick question. Let's see if it was Steve. Over to you, Steve.
No, it definitely wasn't me. Back to you.
Okay, it wasn't Steve. Who else signed in that I haven't gone to so far, except for Paul? We're going to go to Paul very soon. Anyone else?
I think I'd like to just finish that discussion we started about teaching of the electromagnetic theory and how it's taught today in college, over.
Okay. Alrighty. Turns out that Gordon brought up a very good point. Not only is the electromagnetic theory course, as it's taught in our colleges, disappointing and chasing away a number of potentially very good RF engineers, it is creating an impact where we don't have enough antenna engineers in this country, and therefore we're forced to farm out that information. That course has got to be updated, and it's got to be made more what I call engineering useful. If you were the college professor, how would you modify that course, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, having some first-hand experience with it, I can tell you that, without mentioning colleges directly, that I've been somewhat involved with at times, the system is somewhat archaic. They still are doing some of the things that, in this day and age, you scratch your head. I mean, make an equivalency that would you be teaching automotive servicing automobiles today and teaching them how to crank a car by hand? I mean, you know, this is how far back some of the teaching curriculum seems to, you know, slide backwards. However, what I have noticed, and I'll tell you what has happened in this country, you will realize the engineering, like you said, has been outsourced in this country tremendously. Let me let it drop. And the only thing I can use is an analogy, which I was quite amazed. Quite a number of the people that I went to Brooklyn Tech with did not wind up in the engineering field. They found, as far as the amount of, like you say, the experience that you have to put in to get a good engineer, maybe 10 years, sort of will have to be like a journeyman, an apprenticeship and everything before he becomes a full-fledged so-called engineer. Whereas they put the same effort into the medical field, and that was my surprise, how many of them changed over to some part of the medical field and have done extremely well, Dick. So if you want to go by dollars and cents, it surely is a heck of a disparity, and it's not very attractive to state that, you know, that we have to put the same amount of input, but the output is so much different, over.
The only other example I can give of what used to take place, in the high school I went to, we spent more than 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, learning how to cast off by twos in order to do by long division, finding a precise square root, a mathematical function that's kind of archaic, very hard to teach, not easy to remember, and something you don't need. How often do you take a square root? Maybe twice a year. A $5 calculator will do that for you. And even if you didn't have the $5 calculator, you could make a guess at the answer of what the square root is, and eventually make it a little bit higher or a little bit lower in order to get close enough to target. So to spend 2 or 3 weeks in high school teaching that archaic science is no longer appropriate. And I'd like to believe that's been dropped. And the way we teach the mathematical portion of fields and waves seems to fall into that category. It's being taught from the physics point of view, for the point of view of a physicist, and not necessarily a practical, useful information. Strongly felt opinions on my part. A very good friend of mine has just decided to take his graduate courses in electrical engineering toward radio engineering, And the first course he's taking called Antenna Design. They're using a very good book, but the first very large chapter of the book is devoted strictly to the mathematics. The first few tests are going to be devoted to that subject. And this very good friend of mine, because he knows he's got to get a B in every course, let me drop. And in order to stay qualified for a master's degree, he has to get a B or greater in every course. And he knows that that portion of the course is going to give him such grief, he's now on the threshold of dropping the course, auditing the course, and taking it later, hoping to get a passing grade because of that portion of it. Even though this person has worked for 3 years in industry doing antenna design. And he's taking a course in antenna design because it's a requirement for the particular degree he is pursuing. And he's having that much grief. When the professor found out that he already has antenna experience, the professor is trying to talk him into saying, don't let this portion of the course scare you. Good stuff is coming downrange. And my friend is trying to decide whether or not he can believe the professor and whether or not that mathematics will become understandable enough for him to pass the early exams so he gets a B grade in the course. Ridiculous situation, and I don't think it's unique. Anybody with further questions or comments or suggestions on this problem, give me a call. It is right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Continue. This is K2KEY. In my particular situation, scholastically, I can tell you that I was nowhere near the top dog, as they say, the top gun in the class. And but as far as when it was hands-on in the labs, I had a number of teachers that always used to say to me, you've got the feel for it. The other boys, many of them, had a theory, knew the theory, but did not have the feel for it. They could, more or less, I could say, some of them were natural mathematicians, and so they could easily make the theory in stride and do quite well. However, the bottom line was, what I'm going to say, that the teachers, a couple of number of my teachers I used to, they used to take me home to fix their television sets because they were incapable. But when it came to giving out that time, remember, we were going through another recessionary period then in the 50s, in the late 50s. But when it came to getting chipstick, they were the ones that got the, you know, the highest marked overall weighted averages that got the scholarships over.
Okay, the ones that got the highest marks and got the scholarships, I missed one word there, Mel, so repeat that sentence again.
Like I say, in my particular case, being that I wasn't the top gun and all, there were a lot of boys in there that were extremely bright, and when it came to overall average, you know, a scholastic average because of their boost in that they could get, especially in theory. And even though they're practical and they were very inept, it still came down to the fact that they didn't have the love for it like I did, but they got the scholarships, which I did not get because I couldn't come up to that level over.
And when it comes to who is the real radio engineer today, it's you and not them. Sad situation. It definitely needs correction. The curriculum of the Fields and Waves course seems to me that it was set soon after World War II by people who were reading the MIT Radiation Laboratory set of books. And in those days, when it comes to developing the traveling wave tubes and the magnetron tubes that were really doing the transmitting for the radar, yes, it was very elaborate physics-oriented laboratories that were doing that work. And those people were deriving the theory at the same time they're deriving the hardware. And that particular approach in that period of time during that war makes sense. But that doesn't mean that today it's the right way to teach the course. We are 60 years beyond that point, and we haven't changed the way we teach that portion of the theory. When it comes to computer engineering, that course is updated every single semester in order to keep it current. The modern-day consuming public is getting more and more elaborate things that fit into their pocket that are of a wireless nature. So our world is continuously changing very rapidly, but the method by which we teach that material essentially has not changed in 50 years. That's crazy. Gotta change. And who the heck has got the power to change it when everyone's afraid of it and don't understand it? Therefore, they're afraid to make a change. Okay. You've heard enough of my happiness, unhappiness, or whatever. I think we've gone through all the people who we've signed in. Let me give you guys one more chance. Has someone signed in, or has someone listened to this so far and got a question or a comment? Give me a call at us right now. And if there are no further people, then we're going to go right over to Paul. He's going to tell us the latest, what's going on in space. And right after that, we're going to go to Mel's mailbag. So, have I skipped anybody? Give me a call, letters, and name.
Repeater, time out.
I think I heard somebody starting to sign it. Who was that again?
W2TTT.
Go right ahead, Gordon.
Just wanted to point out that I think there's the disease you described for this one course applies to other courses as well, and maybe the whole discipline and other engineering disciplines. For instance, you're in the School of Engineering and the College of Engineering, but your math courses and your physics courses and your chem courses are taught in arts and sciences, and those professors are not happy that you're an engineering student. They're providing it as a service to the engineering school, or the engineering college. And therefore, you're unclean, you're secondary in their world. They're doing it for the money and not for the love of pursuit of the career that you're wanting to pursue. And I think that's the problem. That's number one. Number two, I think that in all too many cases, we need to rethink the way we do education with the astronomical costs involved. I think that if there's someone who's got some good out-of-the-box skills, I think it's important that we put them to work immediately and make education a lifelong process, because in fact, that's the only way you can adjust to the changing needs and environment anyway. And instead of having a 4 to 8 year priesthood exam process, that we make a lifelong educational process. That's my opinion. W2TTT.
I like what you say, Gordon. But now, how are we going to fix it? Gordon, let's assume that Professor Beatty is the Secretary of Education for the United States. You're the man with the juice. You've got the power. What would you do?
I would ask him to look at Steve Jobs our friend who founded Microsoft, off the top of my head, I'm throwing a blank, but anyway, and consider what they have in front of them how that came to be, and that the system essentially did not engage them sufficiently for them to continue in the process. And while that was okay for those individuals, there are a lot of other individuals for whom the process is not working, and a lot of extraordinary inventions happen. I would argue that very successfully. I found a back door into the industry, so it hasn't really bothered me terribly. And the other part is, because of market demand, I found ways to be paid handsomely, thank you very much, without the degree in hand. So now, would it be nice to have a degree? Absolutely. Would it be really useful to have had a degree? Yes. But the process did not provide it in line. It provided it at the beginning, and if you want to go to night school and get your brains in, but if you're in a high-performance job, you're not going to do that unless it's integrated into the work environment, and that's the basis. So that would be my lesson to Dr. X, Commissioner or Secretary of Education.
Very good. Gordon, are you coming in by IRLP? Because your voice is leading as opposed to lagging, if you know what I mean. Your voice sounds good. How are you doing it?
I'm going into 375.
Okay. But 375 is way out on eastern Long Island. How are you doing then?
A V7-144 at about 85 feet in Bergenfield.
Fantastic. Okay, another proof that a good antenna does it. That's where it happens. That's where the rubber meets the road. You want to put out an RF signal, you better put up a good antenna first and worry about the power out of the transmitter second. A QRP transmitter with a good antenna in the right location is where it's going to happen. Let's see what Paul's got to say. Hey, Paul, last Tuesday, a Russian satellite and an American Iridium satellite, I think it was, at 790 nautical miles, smashed into each other head-on over Siberia. As the Iridium satellites all go through the North Pole, they essentially have almost intersecting orbits. So people have been predicting there's going to be a collision, and this particular collision was not predicted. Another collision was predicted at that time, which is kind of amazing. So now hundreds of pieces of space debris have been created, and two extremely expensive, probably $300 million satellites had just become useless space junk, and all of the pieces, all of the particles that were generated in the process are now a hazard to almost everything else at that altitude. The good news is it's not a hazard to the International Space Station, because the International Space Station is down more like 300 nautical miles, and this event took place at 790 nautical miles. So most of the space junk is at a different altitude than our astronauts, and so they think no evasive action is going to be taken, going to be required. So we've had a smashing time in space this week. I hope you're able to come into the eastern input, Paul, and don't forget to reset every minute or so, because if you're able to come in through the eastern input, which is closer to you, Ronkonkoma, not only will you be stronger, but your voice will be clear. On the western input, there will be a fair amount of distortion, as you know. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Fine, Dick. How copy?
Copy is extremely good. Please continue, and don't forget to reset once every minute.
Okay, my antenna is still facing west because I was initially going to use the western link, and not out here. But if it's good, I'll just leave my antenna right where it is. My business. So, okay, on the satellites. Yeah, one was the Iridium, an active satellite, and the other one a Russian inactive satellite. And the Iridium program was set up years ago. The idea was to be able to communicate anywhere on Earth, including the North Pole, South Pole. Those things are at 88 degrees inclination, and so you're able to pick them up anywhere. And I don't know, those things, they have quite a few, and it was a working one, so I guess I'll have to replace it. They used to send them up five at a shot. You know, they'd launch them on a Delta rocket or something, and five satellites at a time. There are six, let's see, I think 66 satellites, and 77 initially, that's where they come up with the name Iridium. It was named after the element, Dick. So, those things are problematic in the beginning. I remember the radio astronomers not being happy about it because the frequencies that they listen to are close to, these operate around 1.6 gigs, so it's kind of like close to the radio astronomer frequencies. I got to watch the timing hit. WS2N. Okay, Dick. And as far as debris, yeah, I heard 10,000 pieces or that many thousands of pieces. We track, the United States tracks some 17,000-18,000 pieces of debris now, including satellites, 900 active satellites, but the debris comes into the many thousands, 18,000-19,000 pieces, anything like 2 inches above that they could track. But as you know, a little flake could hit something. One time they had a flake from a
Israeli satellite hit the front of a, you know, hit the front of the space shuttle, hit the, created quite a ding in the front of the space shuttle window. And that's because the space shuttle was going one way, and when Israel launches, they're not allowed to launch in the same direction. They go all over the opposite direction that we go, because they'd be going over land, and they don't want to do that. So they actually launch east, west instead of east. So the debris from some of the paint, they figured out one little flake hit the space shuttle and created quite a thing, and if one's going 17,000 miles, 500 one way, the other one's going the same speed, going the opposite direction, so quite an impact. So even a quarter of an inch or 1 inch or the size of a BB could create catastrophic damage. Now, nothing's happened since, it has happened before, but on purpose, China launched something in 2007. A ballistic missile knocked one of their own satellites out just to see if they could do it in the same orbital height as these things, and that hasn't caused any problem yet a couple of years later, so maybe that's a good sign that nothing in the future will happen. Let me drop. I just wanted cover a couple of other things I was going to cover last week, but I never did. The launch of Discovery, STS-119, was supposed to go off around the 12th, of February, which would have been weird. That was the same day that they had the two satellites crash, and then they delayed it to the 19th and the 22nd. Now, maybe February 27th, I think, maybe even later than that. They have a problem with these control valves. Apparently, there's some kind of valves that take the hydrogen gas that's inside the shuttle and send that back to the external tank when they're on the launch pad. They've got some problems with the control valve, and they're looking at it, doing tests, and they're really getting themselves involved, and apparently that's causing a delay. But I'd like to see that one go. That's supposed to go to the ISS, and they're going to put up another truss on the starboard side. This truss will bring up the last set of solar panels. Each solar panel set is 240 feet long, and maybe 40, 80 feet wide. One side is 40, and the other one's another 40. So these are huge things that they're going to put up. You're going to add another 66 kilowatts to the system. Each time they did this, they bring up 25% worth of the power that they need for the eventual crew of six. You have a permanent crew of three. The goal is to eventually have six. Initially, when the International Space Station started, I remember they wanted eight, but that was many years ago. Now they're into having six. And that's going to be a 14-day mission, four different spacewalks, and they're also going to bring back one of the astronauts and bring up the first permanent Japanese. So, I'd like to see this last truss to be put in. There's 11 sections of this whole setup that they brought up over the years. And this will be the 11th one, which will complete it. And that brings it to over 300 feet. I think it's 330 feet long, all these truss pieces put together, which includes the center section where everybody lives. And it extends from there eventually to the radiators, gigantic radiators to get rid of the heat. And these huge solar panels, which will eventually, they're online, they'll be rotating. They'll be rotating once every hour and a half, so to keep everything in where the space station doesn't move. As these things turn, they're powered by motors, so the space station doesn't turn. They have gigantic gyros in the center of the space station on the Z truss section, and also on the Zarya module to keep the space station steady. So that should be interesting. See a moving picture of this thing with these gigantic things that are rotating. Also in the space world, let me drop it. They have the Ares 1, they tested one of the rockets, the Ares project. That's the up and coming next manned mission that, you know, we're going to do away with the shuttle. We're going to have the Ares put into operation. And they ran some tests on the rocket. And the Ares 1 will be the first, you know, rocket that will actually launch people. Then they're going to have the other Ares, which will launch the all the big hardware. So for let's say a moon flight, you're going to launch that separately. You're going to have men in one, this one, for instance, that they're testing, and you'll have the lunar module and everything else that you need in the cargo lift vehicle. So that should be pretty good. They're going to actually launch this thing at the end of the year. Going to put it up 30 miles high. Not high, just high enough to test the parachute and have the thing come down and land. So we'll be looking forward to that. I'm going to be looking forward to, in April, the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. That's going up. Going to take very, very detailed pictures. 7 different instruments on board when it orbits the moon. Along with that, it's going to be launched in a Atlas V rocket. That's the heaviest lift vehicle we have. There's going to be another lunar mission going up called LaCrosse. We drop it. Now, the LaCrosse mission, I remember the Deep Impact mission, that one that hit that comet. Well, this is going to hit the moon. They're going to send the spacecraft to orbit, and when it gets close to the moon, it's going to launch this heavy rocket, this part that put it up there, the third stage of the rocket. It's going to crash into the moon, and it will cross vehicle, spacecraft is going to be right behind it, and it's coming in at a low altitude. So the debris from this impact will be, you know, shot up into the above the moon, and as the LaCrosse spacecraft comes through, 4 minutes later, it's going to pick up all the debris and analyze it before it crashes. Some 10 minutes later, you know, that's going to crash into the moon. And you're actually going to have double impact involved with that whole setup. And then, of course, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter will be taking pictures from orbit. And that's not going to crash anyway. That's just going to stay in orbit. And I give them more details for eventual landing sites, you know, in the future. And also, Dick, the Hubble space program is still... They plan on launching a spacecraft to Hubble. Let me drive it. The delay of STS-119 is not going to affect the future launching of the Hubble. They plan on doing that later this year. STS-125, you can Google that and find out all the details about what they want to do with that. And they'll try to put that thing into more updated our operation. But not far behind that, they're already testing the James Webb Telescope, JWT, planned for launch in 2013. So, what do you got, 4 years down the road, that thing's going to be put a million miles out, that's 4 times the distance of the moon, and that will be actually a replacement for the Hubble as the Hubble eventually gets deorbited and sent into the Pacific Ocean. May it rest in peace. So that's pretty much it. I just want to mention one local thing for Long Island. They plan on building the National Synchrotron light source out at Brookhaven National Lab. And it was in Newsday. It's a real big facility. It's amazing to look at the artist's conception. You can see that tiny little... the cars are compared to this big building, and that's going to replace the existing synchrotron light source building that's there, which are relatively small compared to this thing. Gigantic difference. Going to put a couple of thousand, probably, scientists to work on a regular basis, not to mention the building of it, probably 1,000 construction people from the island building this thing. That's pretty much it, Dick. Back to net. This is WS2M.
Very fine, Paul. I've got two questions for you. Number one, La Crosse, its first payload and second payload are going to be smashing into the moon. And you didn't, I don't think you mentioned why. I know that at one time they were talking about the possibility of water existing at the north pole of the moon. I wonder if the smashing of La Crosse will take place near the north pole as a method of detecting whether or not water is present. That's number one. Number two, you said that the International Space Station, when fully assembled, is 330 feet long. That's 10% bigger than a football field. Wow. Is that the length from end to end of the living quarters, or is that the length from end to end of the solar panels? WS2N, KQRIW.
Okay, again, let me find that. I wrote that down here somewhere. 335 feet long on the trusses. 11 sections. You start in the middle, and that's where you have you know, your Destiny lab, and the United States lab. And you got to work out left to right from that, and you've got all these different sections that have been put together over the years. You know, each one's like always 40 feet long, 40 foot long, you know, every time they go up there. And you know, you're looking at 335 feet end to end, and then the solar panels, well, when they're not turning, let's put them in parallel to the all these different modules that have been put up, and they're 240 feet long. So, it's not incorrect really to call it as big as a football field. It's a huge structure. You know, anytime you look at the TV and you see these guys doing the spacewalk, it's amazing. I mean, they've got a train up there that moves, you know, on wheels that goes from one end to the other, a mobile transport unit with robots all over this thing. It's actually got a robot up there, Dexter, attached to the thing. It's got all kinds of modules. You've got the Japanese module, the Destiny module, the two Russian modules, interconnecting modules to connect all these things, which are huge. And then you've got the Quest. That's like a separate room. That's where you would suit up. You know, you close the doors and you can actually stay in there overnight and then suit up and go on for a spacewalk. One after the other, Dick. It's unbelievable. They've got recently, what was it, Columbus, they sent up, European Space Agency sent up another module. So it's big. And the moon story. Yeah, well, okay, you got the lunar reconnaissance orbit are going to be orbiting, polar orbit, taking pictures forever. And then you've got the La Crosse, which is going to crash into the moon. Last time I read, they couldn't decide if it was going to be the North Pole or the South Pole that they wanted to do. But yeah, same idea, looking for water, and they want to test the minerals that come out of the craters. But primarily, it's the same old story. They're still looking for water, and they're going to eventually mine the moon up there and utilize the water to get hydrogen and oxygen, the oxygen to breathe, hydrogen for fuel, you know, all of that, Dick. Back to you.
Amazing. Wow. 385 feet. Whoa. That's big. And something to think about in the future is that...
35, Dick. About... 335. 335.
Okay, 335. That's still darn big. Wow. That's 10% bigger than a football field in length, and approximately the width of a football field. And all of that stuff someday is all going to be coming back, as I see it, Paul. Right now, I got two further questions. What is the prediction as to the probability of finding water? Has anyone made any educated guesses on that one? And second of all, at what time the big rotary joint on one of the solar cells, array of solar cells, was grinding up and giving some grief? Has that been repaired? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, they spent four spacewalks last time doing just that, and they came out with good results. And they know that because they test the amperage on the motors. That's how they test the air. And that came back normal after doing all of this. And yeah, and in fact they greased up the other side too. And one woman spacewalker, she had a type of grease gun, and the thing blew up when she was using that. Actually, it was a pretty dangerous situation, but the thing it blew. I never found out what caused it, and she got grease all over, everywhere. In doing that, yeah, that was last time around, and apparently that's all working. They did whatever they had to do. They cleaned up filings and everything that was there, and greased everything up, and everything has been put back to operational use. Now these things aren't turning yet, but they will be when this final set goes up.
So I think I read that in the process of her cleaning up the grease, the toolkit wasn't being properly tethered. She let go of it and it was lost. And I think I read recently that was a $100,000 item that got lost. And was the original failure a lack of grease, or the grease in the vacuum of space dried out and now they put in a more superior grease? Is that the best guess as to what caused the original failure, Paul? Go ahead.
I can't answer that. I've never read the original cause of the problem. So, I don't know. Maybe there was something that got ground up and that they didn't figure on, you know, one of these bearings or something. My guess. I don't know. But whatever it is, they corrected it. But the amount of power that these things put out are incredible. And I know we've talked about it before. That's why you can have these extended shuttle flights going up there. They suck the power out of these solar panels. Right now they got more power than they know what to do with, and that's why you now have these extended flights up to 2-3 days. And they can probably even go more than that once they have another set of panels up there. And the crew of six, the permanent crew of six should be interesting. You know, flight rules are you need enough spacecraft up there, enough seats to get people out. That means they're going to have to leave two Soyuz spacecraft for years attached to this space, you know, well, for years. They're always going to have six seats available, so that's two spacecraft. They don't leave the Soyuz any longer than 6 months. They won't do that. They'll send somebody back and send somebody else up. So it's not like they'll leave it for years on end. But according to flight rules, they do have to have two spacecraft or enough seats, like a space shuttle or something. When they go up, you know, you have, let's say, seven people on a mission going up, and you have right now always a Soyuz spacecraft attached to bring the existing three back. So when you have six, you're going to have two permanent Soyuz craft up there. We gave up with the X-38 mission. That was nice. It was big enough to hold seven people, and it looked like a little space shuttle, and that was going to be permanently attached. But I don't know. They were pretty far along with that, and they gave up the whole deal. I'd like to see them resurrect that program again, Becky.
When you said the solar panels put out a lot more power than they need, and I know that they can now power the space shuttle when it's connected, and therefore it can shut things down and save a lot of its consumables. Do you happen to know the voltage in amperage? Therefore, we could figure out the approximate amount of power in watts that those solar powers are generating. Paul, go ahead.
Okay, I think everything's 24 volts or something, but the kilowatts on this one panel is 66 kilowatts, they said. So that's one-fourth of what they need, so 6, 12, 18, 20, I guess 240 kilowatts. You know, when you read about it, they always compare it to the amount of homes, the average home. This set of panels would do 30 homes, so... You know, I guess that's the way most people like to think of it. You know, how many homes could you supply? So in this case, it would be 120 homes. Back to you, Dick.
Another way of looking at it, Paul, is 240 kilowatts is a quarter of a million watts of solar power. Those guys are green. Very good. Good stuff, Paul. Thank you. Alrighty. Looks like it's time for... the mailbag, and how are things doing this week, Mel? K2KEY. K2LIW.
I have a question from WHCDO. Two questions.
Go right ahead, Andy. And are you coming into the eastern input, the western input, or are you getting in by IRLP?
I'm on the western input. I haven't been listening because I was busy. Is everything okay on the net? Is it working? Good enough, and can you hear me okay? Can you understand me?
I can hear you quite well, and I'm understanding you very well. Your voice comes through quite clear through the western input. When Eric goes through the input, western input, he's almost unintelligible for whatever reason. The distortion on his particular rig really attacks it. Therefore, he has to come through the eastern input, and when he comes through the eastern input, he was a bit noisy. I was hearing him by way of... directly listening to his input signal to the eastern input. But you sound good, Andy, so go right ahead.
Okay, very good. Just a quick question. Just out of your own thoughts, you heard about this plane crash in Buffalo. They say that all things considered, it looks like icing is what caused it. And my question regarding that is, with all the planes that fly constantly, 24 hours, 7 days a week, how many planes are up there right now with the same icing conditions and don't have this problem? So in other words, can icing really do what it did? Even though they did say that the de-icing circuits were activated, they weren't sure how well the circuits themselves are working, but can icing on a plane really bring it down in that wild manner? I actually said last night that the plane was facing the wrong direction, which is kind of puzzling. Any thoughts, Dick?
Yes, I've got a number of thoughts on that one, Andy. I've been checking with some of my aviation enthusiast friends. That particular aircraft, I've forgotten the model number, has what's called a supercritical wing. It's a very thin, very long wing. The good news is that under normal conditions, the wing is extremely efficient. That's the good news. The bad news is that an extremely minor amount of perturbation to the shape of the wing will make it completely lose lift. There is some question as to whether or not the de-icing equipment was turned on soon enough so it was able to do the work. There is some question as to whether or not the de-icing equipment is adequate for that particular environment. There is the possibility that the flaps were ordered to be put down, getting ready for landing. And that means you've got the trailing edge of the wing, you put something down that's called the Fowler flap. And then the leading edge of the wing, there's something that goes down, something called the slats. And if the slats deployed on one side and didn't deploy on the other side, you could easily go into a flat spin. So one possible explanation as to how the aircraft landed in the wrong direction is that it had lost flying capability, and it was doing a flat spin, and it was in the reverse direction when it hit the ground. The flat spin and the aircraft rotating would explain the pulsating effects that people heard when they listened to the engines, because you're listening to the front of the engine, the side of the engine, the back of the engine, and whatever as the airplane goes into that flat spin. At first, the airplane came down so fast that various people thought it must have come down nose first. Now, as they're studying the wreckage, I think they're coming to the conclusion that it hit flat, but hard. So a flat spin caused by ice on that wing and or deployment of slats or flats on one side only, or loss of thrust on engine on one side, all of those could be explaining it. These are speculations. Back to you, Andy.
Okay, very interesting. I did not hear any further information. I'll hear some tonight on the news. That's the only time that I've been gathering the information slowly. And of course, what a tragedy. And we're only, what, five miles or so from the airport? Not even? But according to the flight recorder, the voice cockpit recorder, no sign of anything happening, which was very quick to the time that the plane went into this so-called flat spin. So it just happened like all of a sudden. It makes you kind of wonder. Whenever I fly, the closer I get to the airport, the better I start to feel that, okay, we're going to be descending shortly and we're going to be coming in. It makes you kind of wonder, especially the fact that, a 45-minute flight? It's not that far. And, they were so close. But I guess we'll find out more. Just for information, that's why I asked the question. Back to you.
That particular French-made airplane has a questionable past in the mind of some people. A good friend of mine who lives in Texas, on a number of occasions, he discovered that the flight he was booked for was going to take place on that very kind of aircraft, and he decided not to take that flight. He drove instead. So that airplane, under ideal conditions, may be okay. But my buddy was unhappy about the fact that when he took flights on that plane, it was extremely noisy. He was sitting in the seat that was near one of the escape hatches, and that hatch was so small that he is convinced that a person more than 250 pounds might not be able to squeeze out of that escape hatch. So from his point of view, the airplane was not properly designed, and that the way the wing was designed push the supercritical characteristic much too far. You may know that, the Voyager aircraft that was made by Richard Rutan and flown by him and Gianna Yeager, and that made a nonstop flight around the world, that also in the beginning was a very supercritical wing, and when they were doing a practice flight over the Edwards Air Force Base, rain occurred, and the droplets of rain on that supercritical wing made the wing lose all lift, and the aircraft went into an uncontrollable dive. Because Edwards Air Force Base is in the vicinity of Mojave Desert, as they descended, the water on the wing dried out, and they recovered the aircraft and survived. That gives you some idea of what can happen when you build a supercritical wing. Just droplets of water on the wing can make it lose lift. WA2CDL, K2RIW.
All right, WA2CDL. Well, if that critical, why keep these planes flying? I mean, they did, however, say that the plane itself has a good safety record. I don't think there's been another an incident like this on this particular plane, not to my knowledge anyway. But at least it gives me an idea of what plane to stay away from. I guess these turboprops are more efficient for these short distances that they fly, you know, rather than a jet. But I think overall statistically, turboprops maybe, like you say, maybe not as safe. But I don't know how many fly at a given day or a given time. I don't know how many flights they have between Buffalo and Newark every day using the same plane. I don't know that statistic. I'm sure that there's a few in number, but not as many, of course, as a regular a jet. All right. I don't want to hurt your ears anymore with this portion. I'll see if I can fix this tomorrow. Back to you to continue with everything else. WH2CDL. Thanks, Dick.
Very fine, Andy. And we'll see you later. I guess now it's time for your mailbag, and what kind of questions have you gotten this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. A few words about the plane. The plane is built by a company called Bombardier. I could say French built, and in Canada. I shouldn't say French, but Canadian. I believe Canadian, French Canadian company, and it's called the Q400. Now, the reason the plane may have been facing the opposite way from the airport is one of the pilots that was interviewed that flies one of these things says that they have gotten word at one time that if you had severe icing on those wings and that those inflatable boots that's supposed to break up the ice, these are not like on some of the other aircraft use heaters. This uses these inflatable, pulsating inflatable boots, rubber boots, that he says what they said is turn the plane around, 180 degrees around, and possibly you'll fly out of this situation, Dick, over.
Okay, that's a possibility. But they had already received landing instructions. They had passed over the outer marker for that airport. They were deploying the landing gear, putting down the flaps, putting down the flaps and slats. By the way, in the voice recorder, they did talk about extra ice they saw on the windshield and on the leading edge of the wing. So there was a voice communication within the cockpit talking about the ice at approximately the time they were deploying the de-icing equipment. So I think there's a slim possibility that the de-icing equipment was deployed a little bit too late for that particular environment because ice had already built up on wing and windshield. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. And they said that usually sometimes a cloud or an area passes through where you will get severe icing, and another plane flying basically, you know, at a little different altitude or whatever, will not experience the same situation. So it's very possible, like you say, the icing built up and being kept in mind that maybe if he swung it around, he could actually fly it back out of this situation and maybe go around again. But, again, maybe the voice recorder, once the analysis completely completed, maybe we'll be able to get more information exactly what took place. But I don't think he spiraled in and turned around. I think he turned around before, intentionally did it, Dick. Over.
I hear you. As they finished doing the analysis of the data recorder and flight deck voice recorder, we'll know a lot more. So, what's the big question this week in the mailbag, Mel?
Yeah, I'm just looking through it. This is K2KEY. I got a lot of questions, of course, a lot that we can't discuss because it's not going to get involved in anymore. We've more or less gone through the situation of what we can, what we can't, what can be discussed, and what can't. Okay, here's one. Constantly getting questions about urban antennas. I guess we opened up the Pandora's box, as we said, when we started discussing all kinds of ideas to stealth antennas and what to do here in an urban situation where there's so much, you know, problems with putting outside antennas, especially if you rent and all, and even more or less private houses or developments where you have the situation that they don't let you go and put on a roof, and I don't care whatever you want to put about this accommodation amateur radio accommodations doesn't seem to be holding a heck of a lot of ground, Dick.